From the live music capital of the world, this is the Austin Music Experience. I'm Jody Denberg. Our weekly show focuses on live music, but there are other stories that make up the Austin Music Experience. This year, we learned about an independent record label that helped put Austin on the musical map, a roots rock legends experiment with computers, a quiet band that would influence Death Cab for Cutie and Blink 182, and a soul man who's had pretty much every job possible in the record industry. This week on the show, we're taking a look back at some of our favorite interviews from the past year. Some of the characters might be familiar: Johnny Winter, Joe Ely, Fontella Bass, Ben Gibbard. But these stories hopefully shine a light on some lesser-known sides to the Austin music experience. Stay with us. This is the Austin Music Experience. I'm Jody Denberg. Any city that bills itself as the live music capital of the world should have a big impact on the music world, and Austin certainly does. This past year, we found Austin connections in some unlikely places. This hour, we're listening back to some of our favorite interviews on the Austin Music Experience, covering Austin's blues beginnings to its indie rock scene and beyond. You might hear outdated references to album releases or shows, but we're presenting this program as kind of a year in review. Who better to start with than Bobby Patterson? He's a soul lifer who released a new album this year at the tender age of 70. It was one of our easiest interviews. You just roll tape and let him cast his magic. We welcome to the Austin Music Experience from Dallas, Texas, one of the greatest soul singers on the planet, Mr. Bobby Patterson, who has a brand new album called I Got More Soul. Nice title, Bobby.
Well, it fits me. Thanks for that nice introduction, first of all. That was one of the nicest introductions I've ever got. Sound like you introducing James Brown or something. Ladies and gentlemen, James Brown! You remember the guy who used to do the introduction?
Well, I could have been even nicer, because the man we've got on the line, Bobby Patterson, since he was 10 years old, so for decades, has been writing songs, playing a bunch of instruments, producing records. He's even been a DJ, he's run a record label, but first and foremost, a recording artist. And the new album, I Got More Soul, you actually did this record right here in Austin, right?
I sure did, at Arlen Studios, which was a nice place to cut a record, man. I mean, it was very nice. People there are so nice, and the facilities are just out of this world, you know. Lots of room and everything. You know how long it's been since I've been in a studio with lots of room? You know, I've been in studios where the vocal booth was in the bathroom, you know.
And you recorded I Got More Soul at Arlen Studios with Zach Ernst, who's a guy we know in Austin from the Honey Bears, and he plays with the Relatives. He's kind of become your partner in arms, hasn't he?
That's right. He's like a right-hand man to me, and Zach, we kind of clicked mentally what we wanted to do with this CD, and we kind of, you know, reverted back to some of the earlier stuff that I did, and we put another twist on that. You know, I recorded a girl called Tommy Young in 71. I had a record called Do You Still Feel the Same Way? So we come up with the song, I Still Feel the Same Way.
I feel the same way about you. Don't think I can live without you. I feel the same.
I also put a cut on there that I wrote and produced by Fontella Bass. It's Hard to Get Back In, which I did myself. I've never recorded that.
Listen up, fellas, I got a message for you. Now when you think you got your thing up tight, you got it on your mind, you're gonna seek God tonight. Don't sell a woman, don't sell a show. Just stop and think, she got her own little cause.
So this new record, I Got More Soul, it's got roots in your older work, plus you're moving into the future, working with Zach. Over the years, Bobby Patterson's tunes have been done by Jeff Tweedy with Golden Smog, Albert King. A lot of people know the Fab T-Birds version of How Do You Spell Love. You said you covered a lot of songs on this record, but you write your own as well.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I wrote these songs, so I guess you could call it covering. You know, it's the first time I ever sang them myself.
That's kind of funny. You wrote these songs, other people did them, you never did them, so it's like you're covering yourself. Although the one song that sounds like it could be autobiographical, Poet, that's an old Sly Stone tune?
Yes, it is. Zach said, let's do the Poet thing, so I put my own twist on it. And, you know, I mentioned a few of the people that have re-recorded my songs over the years. You know, it's Chuck Jackson. I've written songs for Johnny Taylor, Albert King, Fontella Bass, Tommy Young, the Monclaz.
Now, you had these regional hits in the 60s and the 70s, but at one point, you quit making your own records. Why? To go on to produce?
Well, yeah, I did. I got in the other side of the record business. I started promoting records. I had an independent promotion company, which I promoted for lots of different companies. I worked for Capitol, RCA, Atlantic, Streetwise, Profile, Malico, and the list goes on and on, RCA. I probably promoted records for every record company there ever was, you know. I got gold records for LL Cool J, Ron DMC, Frankie Double Dutch, Bus, and a lot of the records that I've worked on over the years, you know. And I decided to get on the stage again. When I hit the stage, I'm in a rage. I don't care nothing about your age. See, I rock your world like a nut do a squirrel. I chase lightning and capture thunder. Walk through the graveyard and make the dead folk wonder. They call me the little piece of leather well put together, brought up on Jimmy Reed, cornbread, collard greens, and black-eyed peas.
Mr. Bobby Patterson is who's talking to you. Bobby, you think in 1996, when you put out that record Second Coming, was that like the start of the latest phase of your career, getting back to it for you?
Yes, it was. It was the start of me coming back as a performer, and because that's what I've always, that's to me my best comfortable place in the music business, you know. I did DJ work for about 15 years at KKDA. So I don't know of any other frontier that I need to conquer really in the record business. If you know one, let me know, but I'll try that too. But I've done everything out here you could do to stay in the business, you know.
What do you think it is that allowed you to be a survivor? Is it the fact that you knew all the facets of the music industry? Is it the fact that you never had that one kind of crazy hit that sometimes goes to people's heads and then puts them off track? What made you a survivor?
Well, I never will. Nothing will in the record business will ever go to my head, you know. I had a mama that made sure of that. Because she hit me upside my head if I get beside myself, you know. While everybody else was ripping and tipping and tapping and making them sexy sounds in the meantime, in between time, Bobby was down here on the ground. They call me the half-cocky disc jockey. This stuff is tight. It sure ain't sloppy. You better watch them others. They ain't nothing but a cheap carbon copy.
Oh, Lord.
See, I always got a level head because in this business, I've worked with so many artists, you know, while I was on the road running with guys and stuff, and I seen these people have one record, and all of a sudden, they own the world, and everybody should cater to them and this kind of stuff, you know? So I never wanted to be that kind of a person because I've always kept a level head and went into this business as a business, and that's what it is. And a lot of artists don't understand that it's called show business. But for the last 25, 30 years, the business has outweighed the show. So they get into the show more than the business, and a lot of them can't handle the business, you know, when it becomes like that and stuff comes to you fast. You get one record and all of a sudden you think you understand the business. I could give you a list of one-hit wonders that never had another hit because that's the worst thing to me could ever happen to an artist is that you have one big record your first time out. Because you don't know nothing about the chitlin' circuit. You don't know nothing about bad promoters, bad record companies, bad musicians, and all of the stuff that you have to deal with while you're coming up. So I'm glad that I never had that one record. You know, it might have went to my head a little bit then, but I'm glad I came up the hard way. I come up on the rough side. I'm just a ghetto man doing the best I can. Full of that dog-head cheese and ready to please.
Well, you came up on the rough side, but things are smooth. You had a great South by Southwest. You turned 70. You got a deal for this new album, which is called I Got More Soul, recorded here in Austin, Texas. This is going to be a great record for you, Bobby Patterson. And I understand you're taking it to Lincoln Center.
That's right. August the 10th, we will be at the Lincoln Center. And I want to tell everybody to break out your soap. I'm going to get out all over you like poison oak. Make you run, tell other folk that Bobby Patterson ain't no joke. I get you jap slapped and woke up out of your nap.
If I had a cape, Bobby, I would throw it around your shoulders. Bobby Patterson, the man, the legend. Thank you, Bobby.
All right. Thank you, Jody.
Bobby Patterson on the Austin Music Experience from an interview originally aired on July 24th. His 2014 album title says it all, I Got More Soul. Coming up, cowboy hats, Apple computers, and Austin's indie roots from the 60s to today as the Austin Music Experience continues. From the live music capital of the world, this is the Austin Music Experience. I'm Jody Denberg. This hour, we're taking a look back at some of our favorite interviews from the past year. You might hear some outdated references, but these stories will help shine some light on some lesser-known aspects of the Austin Music Experience. For example, the American Analog Set. They weren't chart toppers during their decade-long existence, but the Austin band's 2001 album, Know By Heart, ended up influencing everyone from Death Cab for Cutie to Blink 182. Our guest today on the Austin Music Experience is Andrew Kenny, the man behind bands like American Analog Set and the Wooden Birds. First of all, nice to meet you.
It's nice to meet you as well.
And I feel like I met you today for the first time for real, because although I'm familiar with the music of the Wooden Birds, it wasn't until today that I spent quality time with your album Know By Heart that you did with the American Analog Set back in 2001 that I discovered, you know, the light bulb went off in my head. Mm-hmm. And this album is about to be reissued on vinyl for the very, well, it was out on vinyl for a very short time, right?
Yes, it was maybe 1,000 were pressed, and by the time we got back from tour, there weren't any available anymore. So this is the first time it's been on kind of a tender, nostalgic format like vinyl in 13 years or so.
Let's backtrack a little bit. American Analog Set, roots in Fort Worth, Texas?
Yeah, more or less. We're a Tarrant County, I guess, band. But although we never played there.
Oh, ever? Or just when you were forming?
No, we never played there. We played a party. Our first show, I guess, was a house party at my grandmother's house. And we weren't the kind of band that was ever going to have an audience in Texas or in Fort Worth, Texas. And we all loved Austin, and so we all just kind of moved down here. Lisa and Mark were going to school here at the time. We just kind of got together over the summer. So Lee and I followed them back down to Austin.
We're talking with Andrew Kenny from American Analog Set. Did the lineup of the band stay pretty much the same throughout its course, or did it change up a lot?
It changed up a little, and this is a big reason that Know By Heart is a special record for the band, and we lost a member to a lucrative career after 1999, and gained two members just before writing Know By Heart. So it was our biggest turnover we ever had, was right before Know By Heart. And of course, you know, you get a new band together or change members, and all of a sudden all these ideas come out, and everyone's got a little bit of a different attitude and a different vibe on things.
Listening to this reissue, Know By Heart, which has just come out on vinyl by American Analog Set, what struck me, amongst other things, is that it has a timeless feel. You could have told me this record came out yesterday, and I would have said, hey, I really like that new record, which maybe that's a good reason for reissuing it in 2014.
You know, of course, we made the record, so we're not the people to ask if it's, you know, any good. We love it, or, you know, or we wouldn't have shared it with everyone in the first place. always felt like the Analog Set was a punk rock band of some kind. I mean, it was born in, you know, in the midst of grunge and post-grunge, and, you know, boy bands at the same time were kind of popular as well. But really, if you turned on the alternative radio, you weren't going to hear a band like the Analog Set. And I guess, you know, we were making punk rock music. It just happened to be the establishment that we were railing against was also thinking they were making punk rock music.
They were louder.
But, and then some.
The band American Analog Set, the debut album was in 1996 or so, and you put out 6 full-length records of new material through, I don't know, 2005, I guess, something like that.
Yeah, that's right, yeah, that's right.
And this is somewhere in the middle. Why this record to get the vinyl reissue treatment? Does this record stand out to you in the catalog of American Analog Set?
Well, it did at the time, and it does even more so now. People, when they say, you know, I like your band, I have Know By Heart, or no, I have all your records, but Know By Heart is the first one I got, and just for many reasons, I think that album resonated with people. Some of it musically, and some of it just, it was just the, you know, where music was at the time. I mean, it was kind of a simple record.
Reading some of the press that came along with the reissue, there's kudos to you from Blink-182 and Ben Gibbard of Death Cab for Cutie, who you've worked with and recorded with. At the time of the record, I mean, Ben's on the record, right?
He is.
Yeah. So we couldn't say this record influenced him, but I guess your band did.
I kind of hear it. People tell me that they hear it, but I guess Ben is the only one I should really listen to, and he says that he's always loved our band, and we used to send each other demos, and I have a feeling that we both kind of leaned each other in one direction or another, but, you know, who's to say? It's been a long time. Letters from the state. Then you go inside and I walk away.
Now, after American Analog Set, you were in a band called The Wooden Birds, who did a couple of great records in 2009, Magnolia, in 2011, Two Matchsticks. What happened with that Austin band, The Wooden Birds?
Well, I got really lucky, and a lot of good friends that are very talented agreed to join the band, but it was it was built to be a very temporary project. The records were made in a small room with small instruments, and it was very much a songwriter's record, I guess you would call it. And I staffed it with some really gifted people that had a lot of other things to do. So in 2011, they all went back to their other projects. Did you ever know me? Of all the girls that you are, you could write a novel after 20 years with all I forgot. You know, the Wooden Birds, in some way, kind of, it's sad, it kind of busted up right when people were kind of catching on to it. But, you know, the other side of that coin is it lasted for one more record than I thought it would, so I should be thankful, and I am.
And the Wooden Birds wound up on the cover of the Austin Chronicle. They got a lot of airplay in town. You have another hat that you wear, and that is here on the University of Texas. I don't know, would you call it your day job?
Well, I don't work at night normally, so yes.
Come on, give it to me, Andrew.
No, it's my day job, but I work in a very straightforward developmental genetics lab here on campus. It's what I went to university for. I went to UT in the 90s. Usually when people bring up that I'm a rock star scientist, it's because they think that those two are very incongruent, when really I they're kind of the same thing for me. I don't consider myself a gifted songwriter, but I do really enjoy taking a song and working on making it better. And that's through, repetition and distance away from it, and then coming back to it and recording and re-recording and trying to improve upon. And this is very much the scientific method, you know, experimentation, and you revise your hypothesis. My hypothesis is, hey, I can make this song better, and I'm going to test this by, cutting out that second chorus because it's just unnecessary, you know, stuff like that. So I always considered them to be scratching the same itch, at least for me.
Scientist by day, musician probably by day and night, Andrew Kenny. So the Wooden Birds are gone. American Analog Set has this reissue of their album from 13 years ago coming out right now. Is there a chance that you might play more shows with American Analog Set?
Well, no. We don't have any plans to play at all in support of the reissue. We get together and play as friends, and it's a popular thing to do right now to reunite and play shows if you were a band that was popular so many years ago. But I don't know. We got together, and sometimes we play old stuff, sometimes we play new stuff. But we're content just doing biweekly concerts for the five biggest fans of the band, I guess.
You're not closing the door here.
Never. I mean, the Analog Set was barely a band to begin with. You can't break up if you still see your best friends almost every day, and if you can't break up if you're still making music weekly either. So we just kind of stopped doing it. We don't sing outside the shower now, I guess.
But barely a band that put out six full-length records during its
somehow
stint.
Yeah, we did stumble into releasing quite a bit of material over a decade and toured around a lot as well.
Well, those of you with record players, I would recommend getting this reissue of American Analog Set's 2001 release, Know By Heart. And if you buy the vinyl, you get a card that'll allow you to download it as well. Andrew, nice to meet you, and thank you for this music. It's really special.
It was, when we were making it, it just felt like an Austin experience. So I'm glad I get to come share it with the Austin music experience.
Perfect. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you.
American Analog Set on the Austin Music Experience from an interview originally aired on June 12th. The Austin Band's 2001 album, Know By Heart, was reissued earlier this year. This hour, we're listening back to some of our favorite interviews of the past year, so you might hear some outdated references to release dates or shows. Just consider this a look back in time. Earlier this year, Joe Ely looked back in time and told us about his brush with the avant-garde. Our guest today on the Austin Music Experience is Joe Ely, who has a new album that's not a new album. It's called B484. And first of all, good to see you. I hope you're having a good summer.
I'm having a great summer.
This album, B484, first of all, it's Pearls from the Vault, Volume 5. That's your own independent label?
That is, the label is called Rackham Records, but the collection, when I kind of dig down into the stuff that I've recorded over the years, I call it Pearls from the Vault because, you know, living in one place for so long, I've always had my studio here. And over the years, whenever I just get, you know, an idea in my head, I'll go in and lay it down in the studio. And so many of these things have never been released, and now I'm kind of releasing them a little bit at a time.
So this collection, Before 84, I guess the record before it was probably Musta Nada Gada Lada.
Yeah.
And the record after it was called High Res.
And it was called High Res, but this was kind of the in-between time, and it all kind of came about. We had been on the road constantly for 7 years, our band.
You can call out the sheriff and the highway patrol. There's a fool on the road careening out of control. Hard liquor, fast wind. Lord, I can't leave him be. And I wish hard living didn't come so easy to me.
It seemed like New Year's Eve of 82 going into 83. Everything just hit the fan. And Jesse Taylor quit the band. Lloyd had quit a year before that. I just kind of got to thinking, you know, I might want to take some time off. I haven't been in one spot. There was one tour that we started out, it was going to be 3 weeks, and things kept getting added to it, and I was gone, didn't even see my house for a year.
Mm.
You know, my car had been taken away, there were bullet holes in the house, and so I thought, you know, it might be time to slam on the brakes, and that was when I'd just moved to Austin as well. And so I just took some time off and set up a little four-track studio in a little stone guest house at my place. It was around the same time that I discovered the first Apple computer that I had seen. It was called an Apple II Plus.
Using an Apple II is very easy. The only hard part is getting your kid away from it.
And had also run into a Roland 808 drum machine. And all these things looked like a lot of fun. I had time on my hands, and I called my friend Mitch Watkins, and we came over and just tried to figure these contraptions out.
Imagine Houston in the middle of July, hotter than a pistol on a Saturday night. Your baby's on the front porch with a bamboo fan. You pull up to the curb in your black sedan. It don't take her long, she knew you were coming. With a slam of the screen, she's off and she's running. She's sitting there beside you, you forget about the heat. You leave your troubles at the curb, take your passion to the street.
We just kind of played with it. We didn't know what we were doing. We had no goal, no end of the road. We didn't know where it was going. And I started digging out these songs that I'd been writing that seemed like they might go with this new sound that we'd found. And we just tried stuff. When we actually got a whole song together, we were kind of amazed that it had come that far. And so that kind of led us on.
I heard a rumor from a friend of a friend that you got the broken
broken heart. He got the broken heart in the deal. He got the feeling that trouble is real. But nobody wins on the battlefield. But you've got the broken heart.
When we finally got about, oh, 9 or 10 songs together, we played them for the record company, and they thought it was a joke. They thought I was kidding, because they said, you can't do that. You can't make a record. We have to do it in a studio. You know, we have to actually take it to a studio. And of course, I didn't know much about the whole process of making records, even though we'd made a few by then. And so we kind of kept the same songs and went in and started putting a whole drum kit together and filling the studio full of amplifiers.
Hey, operator, cancel a phone call. I hear somebody knocking at the door.
And it was, you know, great project and all, but I kept coming back to the original recordings.
Cool rockin' Loretta, rockin' Loretta.
I know so many musicians out there always discover those first tracks that they laid down, and they're always coming back to them, because there is something about being fresh and kind of innocent in the approach, and kind of doing it without a purpose in mind, just to lay them down.
Well, and I'm a fan of demos. I often like to hear the demos, but I mean, you won't say this, but I will. You're pioneering things here. The whole do-it-yourself aesthetic, the whole thing about home recording, and of course, I don't think Pro Tools, quote-unquote, existed yet. But
well, not even MIDI. You know, the whole MIDI protocol was not invented, and it was just tape machines were barely available, because the four-track little TIAC machine was the only thing musicians could really afford, because the multi-track machines were outrageously expensive.
Is because this was such a departure for everybody that when the record company said you can't do this, that you kind of agreed, okay, I guess I can't do this?
Well, I just kind of went with it, like, okay, well let's do it your way and see which works.
When people purchase Before 84, whether it's online or the physical product, there's quite an essay here from Steve Wozniak, who was the pioneer of Apple computers.
Well, in fact, when he was building those early Apple computers, there was a guy in his same building that was building this sequencer, this Alpha Centauri. And they got together and plugged the Centauri into the Apple and made it work together. And I just thought all of that was really fascinating, because computers were brand new. They were fairly useless, but they were starting to find uses, you know, in word processors, in business, in graphics, and then music. This was the earliest stuff. And in fact, Steve Wozniak says in his liner notes, in 1983, we had no idea that ever in our wildest dreams you could place a whole song inside a computer, you know.
Boy.
One song. And of course, here now we're carrying phones in our back pocket with a, you know, 50,000 songs on them. So.
Exactly. Before 84 is the album from Joe Ely. And that's, we've been talking about the process that led to this record, and then this record led to High Res. There's also a funny photograph in here of Stevie Ray Vaughan. You're wearing a bolo tie that essentially looks like
it's a
mini
computer. Yeah.
And Stevie Ray's kind of punching on it.
Yeah, that was taken in 83 at Fitzgerald's in Houston.
And you know, there's a line in one of the songs, I think it's Cool Rockin' the Red. I'm going to paraphrase here, so forgive me, but I want an antenna, baby, she wants a clothesline, and we'll be living like the rich folks do.
Yeah.
That was kind of the dichotomy of the whole thing. You know, the clothesline is the back porch thing, but the antenna is bringing in the modern and the new, and it's all right there.
I look back at that period of time, and that was a huge changing point for music, because all of a sudden that led to people being able to make their own music. I remember going to the new music seminar that year, and I was on a panel with Madonna and James Brown, and talked about it with Madonna, and she said that they had just had this drum machine in their studio, and she was trying to figure it out. And it was all, everything was all kind of coming to a head there, and it's it's been real interesting to watch the changes in music. Now, most kids have a 24-track tape machine in their computer in their house.
At their fingertips.
Or in their phone, you know.
Yeah.
So it's been real interesting to watch from that earliest time till the present, watching it all change.
Well, the work here on B484 not only set up, in some ways, aspects of your career for the next 30 years, but aspects of the music industry for the next 30 years. So it's nice that you're sharing it on Rackham Records. This is the fifth in the Pearls from the Vault series from Joe Ely. And I know you're getting ready to go on the road. You and Alejandro have got some dates coming up.
It's going to be fun.
And you'll be home with the Flatlander September 20th at the Paramount.
That's right.
Well, Joe, good talking to you about this period of time, and good to have these versions of these songs available to us in our iPods or whatever we listen to.
Yeah, I just thought they need to be out there, because that was kind of a change in time right there.
Thanks, man.
All right, thanks.
Joe Ely on the Austin Music Experience from an interview originally aired on August 4th. His collection of computer and drum machine experiments is called B484. Coming up, a look at a pioneering record label that helped kickstart the live music capital. Stay with us. This is the Austin Music Experience. I'm Jody Denberg. This hour, we're looking back at some of our favorite interviews from the past year, all of which helped shed new light on some more obscure aspects of Austin music. Author Ricky Stein told us about Sonobeat Records on June 5th. Sonobeat was an early Austin label that took on new resonance this year with the passing of its biggest signing, Johnny Winter, who left us in mid-July. We welcome to the Austin Music Experience author Ricky Stein. He has a new book called Sonobeat Records, Pioneering the Austin Sound in the 60s. And Ricky, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
I really enjoyed reading this book because the subtitle of the book is true, Pioneering the Austin Sound in the 60s, because Sonobeat, one of the first indie labels in Austin, and had a lot of the characteristics that then became part of the Austin music experience and the live music capital of the world. Sonobeat Records, 1967 to 1976, is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, that was the period that it was in operation in Austin.
And is it fair to say Sonobeat was one of the first independent labels in Austin?
Yes. I mean, there were independent labels before that, such as Domino Records, but they were mostly short-lived things. There were no studios in Austin back then. I mean, there was hardly, Austin wasn't even known as a live music scene, really. You know, it was right. Known as a cool college town, but not a lot more than that.
So between 1967 and 1976, this label, Sonobeat, puts out 24 singles, a couple of albums, two of which are nationally distributed. The music on the label kind of bridges the gap between psychedelic and progressive country, reflecting what's going on in Austin, and has one of the first racially integrated bands. So many things that reflect the Austin music scene as it grows up. Who are the guys that started this label?
Well, it was started by a father-son duo, Bill Josie Sr., Bill Josie Jr. Bill Josie Jr. Got a job at a radio station called KZZFM and starts going under the radio name Rim Kelly because he thought it was catchier, I guess. But then his dad ends up working as the program manager at KZZ. And they started doing these recordings, these live broadcasts around Austin. Then when they decided to record bands and, you know, release it commercially, what they would do, they didn't have a studio or anything at the time. They would just simply get the band together and talk to the club owners, and they would just sort of empty out the club in the middle of the day. So, for example, the Johnny Winter album, the Progressive Blues Experiment, that was actually recorded in the Vulcan Gas Company during the day. It's not a live album in the sense that it's in front of a live audience, but it is the band playing live just on the floor of the club, that spacious club.
Let's talk a little bit more about the Progressive Blues Experiment. That's Johnny Winter's debut album. It's before he makes the leap to Columbia Records and gets this big signing advance. And Sonobeat Records is in the right place at the right time and has the foresight to record him. Another thing that this label did that then would become commonplace with indie records is they licensed Johnny's Sonobeat record to a larger label, mm-hmm. right? Was it Liberty? I forget.
Yes, Liberty Records.
Did that bring some money to Sonobeat that then they would kind of live off of the rest of their days and sign bands with?
Yes, I wouldn't say lived off the rest of their days, but they certainly, you know, the thing is, at that time, Johnny Winter was as hot of a commodity as you can be musically. And they found him just at the right time and agreed to do this record with him at the Vulcan. Right after they made that record, a big article came out in Rolling Stone magazine declaring Johnny Winter the hottest thing in Texas since Janis Joplin.
The rumors are over. The great new albino blues guitar player from Texas has arrived. His name is Johnny Winter. Listen. The Progressive Blues Experiment, the first album by Johnny Winter, features both sides of his new single, 44, and Rollin' and Tumblin'.
And he became a big star. He played at Woodstock, and there was a bidding war that ensued, actually, for the rights to his next album. And then So Sonobeat already had this album in the can, and they were able to, you know, turn that into a little revenue source for themselves as well.
Ricky Stein is our guest. He has a new book called Sonobeat Records, Pioneering the Austin Sound in the 60s. This label was around from 1967 to 1976. We mentioned Johnny Winter and the band Johnny had at the time, the late Uncle John Turner, the much alive Tommy Shannon, who played in Stevie Ray Vaughan and Double Trouble. Right there, you can see that Sonobeat Records is the thing that sort of gives birth to Stevie Ray Vaughan, and then in turn, Gary Clark Jr. You can trace both of those artists back to this first indie label that you've written your book about. There wasn't really another record as big as the Johnny Winter record for Sonobeat, but there were a lot of different people that came around. I'm thinking of the Los Gonzo guys were already involved, so how were they involved after the Johnny Winter record? Did they make a Los Gonzo record? Or?
Well, you've got the Lavender Hill Express, which had Rusty Weir, and for a time, the Lavender Hill Express even included Gary P. Nunn. Although that was after they had done their three singles for Sonobeat.
Watch out! Round that corner! Here I come!
A lot of these same guys that were recording in for Sonobeat went on to be a big part of the progressive country movement that soon followed. And it makes sense because Sonobeat was recording the top local acts in Austin. And these were the bands that were drawing the most crowd and getting the most buzz, you know. And so it kind of made sense that these musicians would get to know one another and then, you know, end up working together and collaborating.
How about The Conqueror? Were they on Sonobeat? That was Bill Bentley's band?
Yes, The Conqueror and Ed Gwynn as well. And they were one of the first racially integrated bands in Austin. This was kind of still, you know, the 1960s. They only did the one single, but they still kind of have this name recognition, not just in Austin, but in San Francisco. And you know, their records are still, well, the record is still a kind of widely sought collector's item.
So we have the roots of the blues scene in the Sonobeat label. We have the roots of the progressive country scene in the form of the Los Gonzo members and Rusty Weir. And Eric Johnson was involved as well. Roots of the rock scene. Eric, who went on to be a multi-platinum recording artist and win Grammys. Was he working with Mariani?
That's correct. Vince Mariani. And the band was called Mariani. And what that was, well, Eric at the time was just a young kid, you know. 14, 15 years of high school, you know. Vince Mariani was a very accomplished jazz drummer. You know, he actually, the first single Sonobeat release for Mariani was a drum solo. And yeah, as you can imagine, not the most marketable single in the world, but a testament to his skill as a drummer. Vince brings young Eric Johnson on board, and they start this band Mariani. And they were one of the, they did a full album with Sonobeat actually. And as is the case with a lot of Sonobeat's output, it never sold and took hold like the Johnny Winter album did, but it had wild fanfare. It had a lot of people really believed in it. It just kind of didn't hit, you know?
So Bill Josie, the father of the two folks who started this label, he passed away in 1976, which is right around the time that the television program Austin City Limits was launched and really brought Austin to, you know, a national audience. So it was almost the passing of the baton. And up until that point, Sonobeat was kind of it.
Yeah. Well, that the main contribution for Sonobeat was that period between the Elevators and the progressive country movement coming to town.
So the legacy of Sonobeat here in 2014, like we said, there was only a couple dozen singles were made. Are there some of these that are really collectible? Are there people out there, the record collectors of the world, the guys that Doug Hanners caters to with his record convention, that people search for, they go on eBay and look for? What are they and what do they sell for?
Well, a good example is the Conqueroo. Their only single, their only commercial release was for through Sonobeat Records. And that record, I looked online when I was finishing up the book, and it listed for $150 for just the single. So that's $75 a song right there, you know, side A and side B. And but it's history, you know, and it's Austin history, and there's a niche market for it. And there are Sonobeat fans from around the world. Bill Josie Jr. actually started the Sonobeat Records website because of continued interest about the site and about the history and the artists that they recorded. So, yeah, there's definitely still interest in the label, and for good reason. It's great music.
Really fascinating stuff. And as a Johnny Winter fan and as a fan of Austin music in the late 60s and early 70s, thank you, Ricky Stein, for writing this book, Sonobeat Records. Illuminating and interesting. Appreciate it. Johnny Winter on the Austin Music Experience, who came to Austin for South by Southwest, debuted a documentary about himself, and then passed away in July. Author Ricky Stein helped trace his early career with his look at Sonobeat Records. If you missed any portion of this broadcast or you'd like to hear more interviews, head to our website, kutx.org. The Austin Music Experience is a production of KUTX Austin, produced by Art Levy, with assistance from myself. We're back next week with our favorite Austin albums of 2014. I'm Jody Denberg. Good night, Austin, Texas, wherever you are.